Welcome to the debate. Imagine a patient crashing in an ICU.
Oh, an absolute nightmare scenario.
Right. The monitors are screaming, blood pressure is plummeting, and, chaos is basically imminent. So a doctor quickly injects a highly potent drug. The blood pressure stabilizes on the screen, and everyone in the room takes this collective breath.
Because they fix the problem.
Well, it feels like control, right? It feels like safety. But what if the exact drug that just saved that patient's life today practically guarantees their entire biological system will collapse tomorrow?
That's a terrifying thought. But historically, grabbing that steering wheel and forcing a failing number back into the green zone has saved countless lives.
On the surface, sure.
No, not just on the surface. When you are looking at a system in total freefall, whether it's a human body or, I don't know, a crashing global economy, you don't sit back and philosophize about systemic balance. You stabilize the numbers. You do what it takes to stop the bleeding.
And that instinct right there, that drive to force observable variables back into a target range, is exactly what we are putting under the microscope today. We are looking at a brilliant, somewhat disruptive 2026 paper by Dr. Bichara Saheli.
Ah, yes, operationalizing viability.
Exactly. Operationalizing viability, a constraint-based framework for intervention in complex systems. Dr. Saheli argues that across medicine, engineering, macroeconomics, and even social governance, our default control paradigm is deeply, systematically flawed.
Flawed is putting it lightly. He basically calls it a trap.
He does. The framework suggests that by forcing these variables to look normal on the surface, we are actually destroying the system's underlying capacity to survive. We mistake a stable monitor for a healthy patient.
Which perfectly sets up the core tension we are exploring today. Is this traditional control paradigm truly as destructive as Saley claims? Meaning, do we need a wholesale shift toward what he calls constraint-based navigation?
I mean, the paper makes a compelling case that we absolutely do.
Or does this new framework radically underestimate the enduring, gritty necessity of direct variable control? Because frankly, Sahali's alternative relies on theoretical constraints that are impossible to measure directly. I look at this framework and I see an intellectually elegant critique, but one that might completely fall apart in the trenches.
I see why you think that, but let me give you a different perspective. I look at Saheli's framework and see an absolute indictment of how we manage crises, treating observable outputs like, causal levers that we can just pull. It traps us in a cycle of escalating intervention.
But sometimes pulling a lever is all you have.
But it hollows out systems from the inside. Moving to relational constraints isn't just some academic luxury. It's an operational necessity if we want to avoid these catastrophic long-term failures.
I hear that, but I think the paper severely underestimates the reality of the front lines. Direct variable control remains the only bedrock we have when a system is actually dying.
Even if the control is what eventually kills it?
I'd argue that Saheli's proposed solution, this idea of a translation layer where we navigate relationships instead of hard numbers, ultimately just rebrands traditional variable control. And worse, it makes it highly subjective and incredibly dangerous in a high-stakes environment.
Well, to really understand why this control paradigm fails, we have to slow down and unpack the actual mechanics of a complex system. Dr. Saheli talks a lot about non-associativity and path dependence,
Which sounds like heavy jargon.
it sounds like heavy jargon, yes, but the underlying concept is actually incredibly intuitive.
It's basically the difference between fixing a machine and treating a biology, right?
Exactly. In a simple linear system, like a bicycle, actions combine neatly. If you tighten the brakes and then pump the tires, the outcome is exactly the same as if you pump the tires and then tighten the brakes. The order doesn't matter.
Right. A bicycle doesn't care what you do first.
But in a complex adaptive system, the components are tightly, dynamically coupled. If you adjust variable A, the entire system immediately reacts and reorganizes itself. By the time you go to adjust variable B, you are intervening in a fundamentally different system. The relational context changes everything.
Yeah, because the system is actively fighting you, or, trying to adapt to whatever you just did.
Precisely. And this is why treating a complex system's outputs as isolated causal levers creates massive structural misalignment. We force a surface condition. Let's say we artificially inflate that crashing blood pressure.
Which keeps the brain oxygenated.
True. But doing so alters the deeply interconnected relationships that natively generate that pressure. Sahili proposes that a system's viability isn't a target number you can just measure on a dashboard. It's a dynamic, invisible constraint.
Right. He breaks this down into four constantly balancing components.
Yes, the LARS dynamic, load, which is the external demand on the system. Adaptation, the internal effort required to meet that demand. Reserve, the underlying hidden capacity to sustain that effort. And structure, which is the observable configuration we can actually see.
Load, adaptation, reserve, structure. It is, I'll admit, a beautiful way of visualizing systemic balance. I acknowledge the intellectual appeal of mapping it out this way, but I have to challenge its operational reality here.
How so?
Well, if you're listening to this, you're probably thinking, if I can't measure the viability of the system, how on earth am I supposed to manage it? And that's exactly the problem. The paper uses some incredibly dense math to map out this constraint boundary.
The E7 quartic invariant, yes?
Right, the E7 quartic invariant. But even Sal Helly has to admit that this mathematical boundary does not represent a measurable quantity in practice. I come at it from a different way. In a chaotic, high-stakes environment, you cannot effectively navigate what you cannot measure.
But the unmeasurability is exactly the point. It forces us to stop staring at the speedometer and start looking at the engine. We have to look at relationships rather than raw numbers.
But even within the framework itself, Sahili undermines his own critique of control. Look at how he structures the dual-scale paradigm. In phase one, which he calls acute stabilization, the paper explicitly concedes something major.
That you need intervention?
That direct action on critical variables is the absolute only way to prevent irreversible collapse. When a system is in free fall, you must substitute external control for internal regulation. You have to take the wheel.
Temporarily.
So the control paradigm isn't a failure at all. It is the absolute prerequisite for survival. You cannot navigate a system that has already crashed into a brick wall.
I think we need to carefully define what phase one actually represents in this framework. It doesn't validate the control paradigm as a sound long-term strategy. It merely acknowledges it as a temporary tourniquet.
A tourniquet saves the life.
Sure, you apply a tourniquet to stop someone from bleeding to death in the next 2 minutes. But if you leave it on, they lose the limb. To understand why it must be temporary, we need to unpack the mechanism of what the framework calls the load trap.
Ah. The cycle where trying harder actively makes the system less stable.
Exactly. Let's trace how this internal causality works. As external stress, the load, increases, the system naturally responds with adaptive effort to maintain its observable structure. But that internal effort isn't free, right? It consumes reserve.
Which is essentially your buffer.
Yes. It's the physical or economic capacity to absorb shocks. As that reserve gets chewed up and declines, the system's adaptations become fundamentally less efficient.
So every new unit of stress requires, what, exponentially more energy to manage?
Yes, exactly. You enter a catastrophic friction loop. Because your buffer is gone, more effort is required to produce the exact same observable result. You enter a feedback loop, where trying harder actually accelerates the consumption of whatever capacity you have left.
Driving the system closer to the edge.
Right. Beyond a certain point, the very act of the system trying to save itself is what's killing it.
Which is a profound reversal of human intuition. I'll give you that. Usually, worsening conditions demand escalated effort.
To make this visceral, let's use an analogy grounded in the framework's structural concepts. Think of a massive skyscraper during an earthquake. From the outside, the structure, the walls, the windows, the roof, might look perfectly sound.
It's standing straight up.
Exactly. But inside those walls, the adaptation is happening. The steel rebar is actively warping, shifting, and experiencing microfractures to absorb the kinetic load of the shaking. That structural integrity is your reserve.
So you're saying the paint looks fine, but the bones are breaking.
Right. If you only look at the paint on the walls, you think the building is completely fine, but the internal strain is accumulating silently. The reserve is being depleted.
And if you ignore that, the building doesn't just sag, it catastrophically snaps into dust in a fraction of a second.
Okay, that's a highly compelling analogy. The invisible decay beneath the surface. But let's move from skyscrapers back to flesh and blood, because the friction of real-world decision-making changes this entirely.
Go ahead.
Let's look at the paper's own specific clinical case study. Acute decompensated heart failure. You have a patient presenting with crashing blood pressure, a rapid heart rate, and rising blood lactate levels.
Which means their cellular tissues are literally starving for oxygen.
Right. The relationships that sustain circulation are completely failing. At this exact moment, you don't have time to worry about microfractures in the rebar. Intervention must begin with direct, forceful support of critical variables. You push pharmacological support, drugs called pressors.
Which chemically force the blood vessels to clamp down.
Exactly. The drug binds to receptors and forces the vessels to constrict, artificially driving the blood pressure back up so blood can reach the brain and organs. Without that direct target-based control of a macroscopic variable, the patient dies right there on the table.
I'm not disputing that.
But the system collapses. So how can we confidently declare the control paradigm a failure or a, you know, flawed instinct when it is the exact indispensable mechanism that pulls the system back from the brink?
Because if you continue that exact same intervention past the immediate crisis, it will be the very thing that kills the patient. And this brings us directly to the concept of the temporal boundary.
The transition point.
Yes. The framework entirely acknowledges that direct control arrests immediate collapse. But it explains how it does so by creating what Solly calls coherence debt. Think about what those pressors are actually doing mechanically.
Elevating the pressure.
By artificially clamping the blood vessels to make the pressure number look good on the monitor. But by clamping those pipes, you massively increase the resistance the failing heart has to pump against. You are forcing a sick organ to work twice as hard, further starving the tissue of oxygen.
You are substituting external chemical force for internal physiological capacity.
Perfectly said. You are borrowing time at an exorbitant interest rate. If that forceful control continues past the temporal boundary, a structural shadow emerges.
The divergence between appearance and reality.
Right. The observable output, the blood pressure on the monitor, remains stable. The structure looks completely fine. The doctor might even give a thumbs up. But the internal capacity, the reserve of the heart muscle, is being quietly drained to zero by the excessive adaptive effort.
So you're saying we have to switch tactics.
This is why the shift to phase two constraint-based navigation is so critical. The logic of intervention has to completely fundamentally reverse. Instead of escalating effort to force the output up, you must reduce demand to allow the internal relationships to restore their own coherence.
Okay, I hear the theory. But I'm sorry, I just don't buy that this transition is as clean as the framework implies. Let me tell you why. I deeply question the clarity of this so-called temporal boundary.
Why? It's the moment the system stops responding linearly.
But the paper states this boundary is reached when, quote, basic function has been restored, and the system begins to show some responsiveness. Think about the sheer chaos of a collapsing economic market, or that ICU patient we just discussed. Identifying the exact magical moment when basic function is restored is incredibly ambiguous.
Well, it requires immense clinical or managerial judgment, certainly.
It requires omniscience. If you miss this vague boundary and continue your direct control a little too long, the transition fails, and the coherence debt destroys the system from the inside out.
That's the danger of the structural shadow, yes.
But if you initiate phase too early, if you back off your interventions before the system can actually support itself, it crashes immediately. The entire framework hinges on a practitioner recognizing an invisible, mathematically unmeasurable threshold using indirect signals in the middle of a life or death crisis.
That's an interesting point, though. I would frame it differently. The ambiguity you are pointing to isn't a flaw in Solly's framework. It is a fundamental feature of the reality we are intervening in.
A rather inconvenient feature.
But complex systems simply don't have clean binary transition points. The framework doesn't just shrug and leave us blind, though. It gives us the concept of the structural shadow as the ultimate warning sign.
Okay, how so?
How do we know we have crossed the boundary? We stop looking at the absolute number
and we look at the relationship between effort and output. If our adaptive effort, say the dosage of the drug or the billions of dollars in economic stimulus, is constantly rising, but the output is merely remaining constant or showing diminishing returns, we are deeply in the shadow.
So effort goes up, output stays flat.
Exactly. That is the empirical, observable signal that the temporal boundary has been crossed, and our control is now actively destabilizing the system.
But how do we actually interpret that signal operationally? And this leads to my biggest critique of the entire paper, the translation layer.
Okay, let's get into it.
Salehi argues that because we can't measure the viability invariant directly, because we can't see the exact moment the system will snap, we have to move from components to observable proxies and interpret data relationally.
Right, looking at how variables change together over time.
Sure. In the clinical case, it means tracking proxies like lactate levels, which indicate metabolic stress, or urine output, which indicates whether the organs are actually getting perfused with blood.
Which provides a vital window into the state of the system's reserve and adaptation, rather than just staring blindly at its structure.
But let's be real about what's happening on the ground here. Practically speaking, tracking lactate and urine output to guide your intervention is, functionally, just reverting to target-based variable control.
I disagree.
You have just picked a different, slightly more nuanced set of variables. You are still looking at a number on a chart and deciding whether to increase or decrease your intervention based on whether that specific number is moving in the right direction. Are we actually navigating complex relational constraints, or have we just realized that blood pressure was a bad target variable and lactate is a better one?
I'm not convinced by that line of reasoning because it misses the profound paradigm shift the framework is asking for. We are observing direction rather than value.
Direction instead of value.
Yes. In the control paradigm, achieving a specific value, like a stable blood pressure of 120 over 80, is the very definition of success. But in the constraint framework, a stable blood pressure that is only achieved through rising effort and declining reserve is recognized for what it is, a massive impending failure. We aren't just substituting lactate as a new target to blindly optimize.
Well, the paper does explicitly warn about the squeeze condition, where escalating intervention based on managing proxies produces worsening outcomes.
Right. The squeeze condition is the perfect illustration of this trap. If a doctor treats lactate as just another target variable to force down, they might escalate interventions, pushing more fluids, more drugs that actually further deplete the system's reserve.
Making the cure worse than the disease.
Exactly. And to really see how this transcends just picking better variables, let's step out of the hospital and look at the framework's cross-domain generalization regarding governance systems. Imagine a massive governance crisis, like severe civil unrest.
Okay, switching gears to social systems.
The observable structure here is institutional order. If you apply the traditional control paradigm, you look at the unrest and you increase police enforcement to maintain that order.
Which works temporarily to stop the acute collapse of civil stability. I mean, people get off the streets.
Temporarily, yes. You establish phase one stabilization. But increased enforcement requires massive adaptive effort from the state, and it systematically erodes social trust. In this system, social trust is the reserve.
It's the hidden capacity.
Exactly. It's the buffer that makes society function without constant force. So the structure remains stable. The streets are quiet, the protests stop, but the structural shadow is growing rapidly. If a politician only looks at the target variable of compliance or crime rate, they think they are succeeding brilliantly.
Because the numbers look good.
But relational navigation forces you to see the invisible decay. A stable compliance rate achieved through escalating enforcement and deeply depleted trust is a mathematical trajectory toward collapse. It completely breaks the illusion that a stable proxy equals a healthy system.
It's not just about hitting a metric anymore.
No, you aren't targeting a number. You are evaluating whether your intervention is moving the system toward or away from a state where it can organically maintain itself without your constant, forceful grip.
I understand the distinction you are making between valuing a specific static number versus observing the relational direction of the system. It's a vital distinction.
But even in your governance example, the decision maker still has to look at observable metrics, arrest rates, protest frequency, economic activity, to determine if trust is actually depleting.
Naturally, you need data.
Right. The translation layer explicitly relies on proxies, and human nature being what it is, the danger of proxies is that people inevitably start managing the proxy instead of the system. It's Goodhart's law. When a measure becomes a target, it ceases to be a good measure.
That is a well-documented trap, yes.
The framework requires a level of operational discipline and systemic awareness that might simply be unachievable in high-stakes environments. You're essentially asking practitioners to suspend their reliance on the very concrete metrics that tell them if the patient or the economy or the society is dying right now in favor of complex relational trends that take significant time to emerge.
It is absolutely a heavy cognitive lift. I won't deny that. The framework demands a fundamental rewiring of our brains. We have to stop asking, what is the value of this variable, and start asking, what is the true cost of maintaining this variable?
And my point is that when the system is acutely destabilizing, you simply don't have the luxury of calculating the long-term cost. You just have to pay it to survive the night.
But eventually the bill comes due.
Sure. But the dual-scale paradigm proves that constraint-based navigation is a luxury of a stabilized system. The control paradigm does the dirty, ugly work of keeping the system alive long enough for elegant navigation to even be an option.
I think we have arrived at a fascinating synthesis of our positions here. If we zoom out and summarize the deep implications of Dr. Solly's framework, it mathematically and practically exposes why substituting effort for capacity is a fundamentally doomed strategy.
It is certainly a sobering warning.
The shift to constraint-based navigation is vital because it actually respects the nonlinear, path-dependent realities of complex systems. It forces us to acknowledge that infinite escalation of control doesn't secure a system. It merely creates a structural shadow,
masking the real damage.
It hollows out the reserve until it causes the very catastrophic collapse it originally sought to prevent. We must learn to manage the delicate, dynamic balance of load, adaptation, reserve, and structure, rather than just pinning the needle on a single dial and hoping for the best.
And I would summarize my position by saying that while the relational theory is deeply insightful regarding the hidden limits and delayed cost of our interventions, the practical, gritty realities of preventing system collapse still fundamentally rely on the control paradigm.
As the anchor.
Right. The translation layer and the reliance on proxy management demonstrate that direct variable control remains the unavoidable anchor. You cannot interact with a complex system without touching its observable variables, especially during acute life or death stabilization.
Yet, despite our different angles, we both firmly agree that the paper brilliantly exposes the phenomenon of coherence debt.
Oh, absolutely.
The idea that the very interventions which save a system in the short term actively degrade its ability to survive in the long term is a profound, unsettling insight. We both recognize how dangerously easy it is for practitioners across all fields to mistake surface stability, that quiet structural shadow, for actual systemic health.
It's true. The concept of the load trap, where trying harder actively destabilizes the system because the reserve is quietly depleted, is a pattern that every seasoned physician, engineer, and policymaker will immediately recognize from their own painful failures. It perfectly articulates why some of our hardest-fought battles still end in defeat.
There is so much more to explore in Dr. Saheli's framework, particularly the final section on the axiomatic conditions for viability, which details the specific mathematical principles for preserving reserve and regulating load over long periods of time.
It's a dense read, but a worthwhile one.
We will leave it to you, the listener, to explore those concepts and decide for yourself whether true constraint-based navigation without relying on the crutch of variable control is practically achievable, or if it remains an aspirational theory.
It really does challenge everything we think we know about fixing problems.
It really does. Which brings us right back to where we started. When you grab that steering wheel, when you aggressively force that dial back into the green zone to make the alarm stop, you might just be maintaining the illusion of a working machine,
while completely ignoring the fact that the engine itself is quietly burning away.
A terrifying thought for anyone in charge of the wheel.
Indeed.
Thank you for joining us.